for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The British oil giant BP is trying to cap one of three leaks at a mile-deep well spewing oil into the Gulf of Mexico. But so far, everything engineers have tried to contain the spill has failed. Administration officials plan to meet with BP executives later in the day about how the oil giant will cover costs related to the massive spill. And President Obama has vowed to do everything for as long as it takes to stop the crisis. Joining me in the studio, Stephen Power of the Wall Street Journal, Rayola Dewar of the American Petroleum Institute, Coastal Louisiana author Michael Tidwell, and Jacqueline Savitz of Oceana, that's an international conservation group. Do join us. I know many of our listeners are directly involved. Give us a call, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can also join us on Facebook and Twitter. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Stephen Power, if I could get you, we now have 5,000 barrels of oil leaking from this damaged well every day. Give us a brief timeline of just how this crisis occurred.
Sure.
And the steps taken to stop it.
Sure. So this accident happened on April 20th. There was an explosion aboard the rig, the Deepwater Horizon, located in the Gulf of Mexico. It's not clear what caused the explosion. The ensuing fire raged for 2 days, and on the 22nd, the rig ultimately collapsed into the Gulf. The initial response by the government, as you can imagine, was to focus on finding the people who were aboard the rig, people who were missing, focusing on rescuing those people. Ultimately, there are still 11 people missing, believed to be dead. And in the initial days, it was estimated that the rig was leaking about 1,000 barrels a day. That was the estimate from BP. Last Wednesday, BP and the government came to the conclusion that it was a far greater rate of leakage, now 5,000 barrels a day. It's believed by some experts in this field that it could be significantly more. The fact is the experts really don't know how much is leaking per day, because this is somewhat more of an art than a science in terms of how you calculate how much is actually coming out of this leak. And it's different from the Exxon Valdez spill, because in Exxon Valdez you had a tanker, so you sort of knew what the finite amount was. But in this case, you're talking about a depth of roughly 5,000 feet. They're relying on robots to help seal these leaks. So since Wednesday, there's been a much greater urgency placed on this, as you can see from all levels of government. The Obama administration has sent Interior Secretary Ken Salazar, Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano, and the head of the EPA, Lisa Jackson, down to the Gulf Coast area to work with the agencies, and as Secretary Salazar put it on one of the news programs yesterday, to keep the boot on the neck of BP, to make sure that BP is bringing all of its resources to bear. They've engaged President Obama has directed the military to get involved with the Navy and the Air Force, offering their resources. But at this point, appears to be some degree of desperation on the part of both BP and the government to fix this problem.
Help me to understand what this looks like, Stephen. A mile beneath the surface of the water, what does it look like down there, and why is it spewing? Is it coming from beneath the ocean floor? Where is it coming
There's
from?
There's a wellhead and a series of contraptions that are built above the area where this oil is emanating from. It's a series of what they call rams and housings and valves that are stacked on top of one another. Somewhere in there was there was a surge of pressure. They don't know yet what caused it. What they're trying to do, the latest statements from BP is, There are several leaks that they're trying to contain. One way they're trying to do that is by installing a shutoff valve on top of one of the leaking areas of the pipe. They're also trying to install some containment domes, these structures that are somewhat box-like that they could put over the two other leaks, including the one. There's one one riser that has the biggest, believe me, the biggest source of the oil. All this occurring 5,000 roughly feet below the surface. It's been likened in some ways to the Apollo 13 situation, also in the sense that you had remote control people in Houston trying to work remotely with the technology, but not able to really see what's going on themselves, relying on this technology at a great distance.
Stephen Power, he's a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Turning to you, Michael Tidwell, this has been described as 30 miles wide. Give us a sense of the kinds of effects that this could have, not only to that waterway, but to the coastal area itself.
Well, at first, the oil spill was considered to be about the size of Rhode Island, which is very, very large. Now it's considered to be much larger than that, maybe the size of Puerto Rico, getting larger, maybe 130 miles wide, heading toward the coasts of Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama. Couldn't come at a worse time. Millions of migratory birds travel through these wetlands this time of year. That's critical habitat for reproduction, for food. The brown shrimp season is just getting started. The shrimpers in Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana call it the May season. They usually start in early May. They go through June. They make half to three quarters of their money right now. And now those east of the Mississippi River cannot shrimp at all because of the NOAA decree that all fishing, commercial and recreational stop. Huge impact on tourism. Already tourism bureaus are reporting a decline in bookings along the Gulf Coast. This could be $5, $10, $15 billion in impacts just to seafood and tourism alone. It could be much more if this goes on for months, as some people indicate.
And when you say it could go on for months, does that mean it could spread, it could widen, it could travel?
Well, if these containment domes are not successful, these last measures to try to stop the spill at the source.
But even with the situation as it now is.
Well, there's enough oil in the bank, as it were, in the Gulf, that once it touches, especially the salt marsh, these grates, not like the hard rocks of Alaska where we had the Valdez spill. This is grass that absorbs the carbon products. It causes death, the decline of the grasses, which leads to more erosion, and frankly makes the next Katrina more inevitable. So you've got massive die-offs of grasses. There's a chance that, you know, the oceans are not static. There's currents, and the Gulf Stream actually begins in that part of the Gulf of Mexico and could literally take that oil spill all up into the East Coast as far north as the Chesapeake Bay in terms of the sheen and concentration of the oil. So we're talking about something on a major ecological scale. And there are those in the oil business who say, well, you know, we have to have oil for our cars. You know, this is a cost of business. Well, I think the country is about to see what the true cost of this business is and may have to ask themselves, is this what we want?
Michael Tidwell, he is the author of Bayou Farewell and director of the Chesapeake Climate Action Network. Jackie Savitz, turning to you, how much of an impact could we possibly see, not only on fish and wildlife, not only on tourism, but life itself along that coast?
That's a great question, Diane. You know, the people down in Louisiana, as Mike can tell you firsthand, seafood isn't just a business to them. It's a way of life. It's the fabric of their life. And so it's one thing that it affects fishermen, small businesses, mom and pops who did nothing to bring this on themselves. But it also affects their way of life. And as this continues, as Mike said, it could affect the coastal tourism industry. And all of this can be because either the fish are contaminated or because they can't fish. Or maybe they can fish, but there's actually a perception problem that comes into it, as it did in the case of Katrina. It's really, you know, I think the best way to describe it is it's a lose-lose-lose situation, and the only the two things we have to do, stop it and prevent it from ever happening again.
Jackie Savitt, she's Pollution Campaign Director, Senior Scientist at Oceana. And turning to you now, Rayola Dewar, BP had said before this project began that it had taken every possible action to prevent any kind of risk or damage, and that it felt any damage would be minimal. How do you compare, contrast what has happened to those words from BP? Did they totally miscalculate?
No, they didn't. We don't know yet what the cause of this accident was, but we have 3,500 platforms in the Gulf of Mexico operating safely. This accident comes as a real shock to people in the industry. And literally for generations now, what this business does is really focus on the safety, on the technology, on moving that envelope, going to new frontiers. It is their entire focus, both the welfare of our workers as well as the production and the viability of our facilities. And we believe in that technology. And we saw what we were able to do during Hurricanes Rita and Katrina offshore, and we looked at that and said, well, this is proof of that technology. Now, just like an airline accident or other catastrophes that we've seen, we have to go back and figure out what happened and make sure it never happens again.
Rayola Dewar, she's Senior Economic Advisor for the American Petroleum Institute. When we come back, we'll talk further about those 3,500 other platforms. And a few tweets from our listeners on the tragic occurrence there in the Gulf. First, what about the 11 dead? Most coverage is about the environment. Miners got lots of attention. Why not oil workers? Stephen Power.
Yeah, there are 11 workers who are still missing. I don't know off the top of my head what the Coast Guard has said about the. I know the Coast Guard has called off efforts to find them, which suggests that they are in fact have perished. I mean it's an enormous tragedy for those families, and President Obama reiterated his condolences to those family members. Yet, but it's been made more complicated by the fact that they are missing. So you haven't maybe had the same sense of closure as you had in the case of the mining accident, where the bodies were ultimately retrieved.
Now the question certainly becomes: do you presume that BP we'll be picking up not only all costs of the cleanup, and how they're going to do that is a question in and of itself. But what about the 11 dead? Will there be reparations for those people?
Well, I'm sure those families are looking into that right now, and I can't speak on behalf of BP and what, I mean, their lives are invaluable to their families. So, there's that's an invaluable. You can't replace someone you love.
Do you believe that BP has the resources to pay for all of these cleanup costs?
I don't know what resources they have. I know that they're insured. I know we have a spill prevention fund, about $1.9 billion in that. So they have stepped forward and said that they will accept claims made against their company. But first and foremost, I think we're going to have to find out, too, the direct cause of the spill. Was it technology? Was it a piece of equipment? Was it a procedure? Was it the cementing? Who was responsible in the end for, you know, for the cause of the spill?
Yeah, there are several corporate actors here.
Right.
BP, by the law, under the law, is the responsible party because it's their oil. There's another company called Transocean. Transocean is a Swiss company, and they were the operator of the rig. They were doing business with BP. It was their people. You've started to hear Tony Hayward, the CEO of BP, pointing that out more often in some of his public communications. There are already lawsuits being filed against not only these companies, but against Halliburton, which did some of the cementing work, I believe, for this rig. And then there's another company that actually made the blowout preventer, which is the piece of technology that is supposed to be sort of the last line of defense against something like this. And this is a piece of equipment that apparently did not work. So there are a number of corporate parties that are going to be looked at here.
Mike.
Diane, I think it's really important that the American people try to get a sense of the scope and scale of offshore drilling in the Gulf of Mexico. It can help us understand the risk and the operations. You know, we think of offshore drilling, we think of a few dozen or a few hundred brave men out there on a few dozen rigs off the coast of Louisiana or off the coast of California. No, in the Gulf of Mexico, oil platforms are the Gulf. If you look at nautical charts, there's thousands of them, 4,000 drilling rigs and oil production rigs. There are 35,000 wells that these platforms connect to. I mean, there's so many in the Gulf on nautical charts and maps. They look like stars in the sky. They literally, coincidentally, form their own constellations. So a boat captain will say to another, I'm passing the bunny ears and coming up on the barbecue pit. And if you go out in the middle of the Gulf, as I have at night, to out to these platforms 100, 200 miles out, the hazard lights and the bright lights on each one of them on a starry night, they look like the reflections of stars down on the ocean. Now, the point is this, the volume of production with 35,000 people offshore, almost in an outer space type situation where every drink of water, every bite of food, every wrench has to be brought to them from the world of earth and trees, from the coastline, the volume means that this sort of human error is inevitable. It may not happen again in a week, it may not happen in a year, but when you have that many wells, like stars in the sky, this will happen again through human error. And we have to ask ourselves, is this the cost of business we really want to accept? What odds are we willing to take? Or do we want to find another form of offshore energy like wind and alternatives to oil?
Jackie.
Absolutely agree. You know, it's interesting. You asked about the costs, and Ray mentioned that she thinks BP is insured. Well, I read in the Washington Post this morning that BP has a corporate policy of self-insuring, which means they may not be insured. And I think that raises some questions. So that we open up our coast to these companies that are going out there to make a profit on oil offshore. They have an accident like this that you can't really pay for, an accident that you can't replace the loss of life. You can't replace the marine life necessarily, although we'll make them try. Fish like bluefin tuna that are extremely important commercially. And as Mike says, with thousands of wells out there, we know that some of it has to continue, but do we have to expand it into places where it hasn't already been done, where we haven't already industrialized our coast, like the East Coast and moving closer to Florida?
Here is an email from Jack in Flint, Michigan. He says, I can only hope that those folks who thought we should tap some small reserves under Lake Michigan with offshore drilling are paying attention to the devastation in the Gulf area. Imagine if that were in the largest bodies of fresh water in the world. Steve.
I think there's no question that this accident is going to have tremendous impact on the debate over whether to expand offshore drilling. I don't think there's any dispute likely over that. I mean, part of what makes this such an amazing event is that the oil and gas industry just a few weeks ago had seemed to be on the verge of achieving a significant policy victory. You had President Obama, who was not much of an enthusiast for offshore drilling during the 2008 campaign, coming out with a plan to somewhat expand offshore drilling in the eastern Gulf of Mexico and saying he would consider adding areas in the southern Atlantic. You know, over time, the industry's the frequency of spills relative to the amount of production has been pretty low. I mean, according to the Minerals Management Service, offshore operators produced roughly 7 billion barrels of oil from 1985 to 2001 with a spill rate of only 0.001%. So the frequency of these spills caused by the rigs themselves was pretty low. But as we can see in this case, I mean, it takes one really bad accident, you can have tremendous consequences.
All right. I want to open the phones, 800-433-8850. First to Fort Wayne, Indiana. Good morning, Luke. You're on the air.
Good morning. Yeah, I work for BP in what's called the non-destructive testing industry. We help maintain safety standards for the petroleum industry and for other industries. And I can tell you that BP's safety standards and BP's way of operating loans itself to systemic safety issues. They constantly will try to undermine safety and undermine standards for production.
To what extent are you saying that undermining was under the last leadership of BP and has changed with the current leadership, Luke?
You know, I understand that there's been a leadership change, but those things are top-down and they take a while to work their way down to those bottom areas. But when you're talking about crew leaders or crew chiefs, you know, telling people, well, that well's almost okay, so let's count it, let's wrap it up and bury it. You know, that kind of stuff takes a while for them. Those types of policies take a while to change.
Steve.
BP has had some very serious safety problems in recent years. That's another thing that makes this tragedy all the more in some ways mystifying, because Tony Hayward, the CEO, he succeeded Lord Brown as the CEO a few years ago. He came in, really tried to refocus the company on improving its safety and maintenance operations. He seemed to be making progress, but this one accident threatens that efforts he has made.
I wonder, Mike Titwell, do you believe in light of this accident that all these wells ought to be closed down? Would you go that far?
No, of course. All these wells should not be closed down. But we have to begin a transition from oil to our next future energy source. It has to. I mean, look, there haven't been many spills in the Gulf in recent years, in part because of some improvements in safety, but frankly, in part because of luck. Look, again, at that volume, 35,000 wells. It's an offshore colony that boggles the mind. I've been out there. It's amazing. It dominates the landscape. They're everywhere. At that scale, human error ultimately will play a role, and you will have spills like this. Now, I think at a minimum right now, we should renew the moratorium on offshore drilling. For example, if this same well that we're seeing in the Gulf of Mexico were off the coast of Virginia, where Bob McDonald, the governor of Virginia, can't wait to start drilling off the coast of Virginia, there's estimated to be at the most 6 days worth of national supply of oil off the coast of Virginia. But if that spill had happened in Virginia, it would right now already be from Bethany Beach, Delaware, all the way to Virginia Beach. It would have covered Assateague and Chincoteague Islands. What risks are we willing to take for 6 days worth of oil off the coast of Virginia?
Ray, do you want to comment?
This is a heck of a lot more than luck that have prevented accidents from happening. They have, in terms of the technology, the safety, everything we've done to address this for many, many years now. It has nothing to do with luck. It has everything to do with the care and operation of these facilities. And I want to say something for those workers on those platforms. No one takes this more seriously than they do. So, and no one works harder to ensure that there is safety there. And there are procedures in place. My institute works very hard in terms of designing some of these practices and standards and making sure that we are as safe as we can possibly be.
Jackie.
Well, since we're still going to continue to drill, obviously, in the western Gulf of Mexico, we're going to need safety standards, and it's good to hear that they're still working on them. But the bottom line is, no matter how much safety standards, it's their entire focus, I've heard, No matter how much there is, it's clear from this accident. It demonstrates that it's not enough. We've known that oil is a dirty and dangerous business. We know that we have to shift from fossil fuels to clean energy in order to stop climate change. And one way to start doing that is to say, let's say no to any new offshore drilling. Instead, let's start thinking about alternatives like offshore wind and solar.
Steve, do you think that's likely?
Well, I think that you're still going to see, President Obama has said that, you know, it's roughly a third of domestic production comes from the Gulf, so the U.S. is going to need to continue producing from the Gulf. And I think you are still going to see efforts to pass climate legislation that do incorporate some expansion of domestic production. But what this accident does is refocus attention on the real risks that come along with any expansion of drilling in any part of the country.
So would you possibly see an expansion of attention toward wind energy as an alternative?
Well, that's something that the Obama administration has been trying to push forward, various alternative forms of alternative energy. Just last week, you saw Secretary Salazar announcing a decision in favor of the Cape Wind Project. This is going to be the nation's first offshore wind farm off the coast of Cape Cod, and that's been fought for many years by a number of local homeowners, landowners, some of whom object to the potential impact on their views of the ocean. I think most people would agree that the U.S. is going to need to continue to produce domestic oil and gas.
Stephen Power, reporter for the Wall Street Journal. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Now to Grants Pass, Oregon. Good morning, Marie. You're on the air.
Good morning, everybody. I was born and raised in England during World War II, and I believe this is sabotage. I don't think it would break that far down without some help from somebody. Plus, if BP is leasing it, don't the owners that own it have some responsibility to the cleanup?
Yeah, we talked a bit about that briefly, but let's take on the sabotage question because I do think a lot of people have been wondering about that. Mike?
Well, who knows? I mean, in the same way that BP and the government say we don't really know, we can't measure how much oil is coming out, it may be the case that we never know exactly what went wrong. I haven't heard anyone mention sabotage. It's more likely that human error will be involved. Somebody made a bad judgment. Somebody made a faulty part. But even if it were sabotage, the consequences are what we're seeing. The energy itself is dangerous. Look, I know people who work on the oil rigs. I've been out on the supply boats and the crew boats and up on the platforms. I know the people, good Cajun people and Mississippi people who work out there. They sacrifice their health. They fall off ships. They break their backs. It's dangerous work. There's 1 to 2 fires or explosions out in the Gulf on rigs every week. One person dies every 45 days. This is dangerous business. But unlike, you know, there have been those that say, well, if a space shuttle blows up, do you end the space program? Or there's a car wreck and someone dies, do you stop all car transit? No, you don't. But that's not the fair comparison because all you need is one oil catastrophe and you can shut down the economy of the whole Gulf Coast. One catastrophe. And so we have to ask ourselves, are the odds worth it? Wouldn't we prefer the Cape Wind Project that Steve mentioned? You know, 420 megawatts of wind power can power 150,000 homes. If a hurricane knocks down every one of those windmills, if they're all knocked down, there's no pollution whatsoever.
All right. To Cleveland, Ohio. Good morning, Dave.
I was just listening to the conversation, and I seriously questioned the cleaning technique of BP. You know, Diane, it just seems to me that the original viscosity of the spewing fluid is easier to corral in that particular location. And it's easier to corral and easier to remove, and that even a more vicious density would be more friendly to the ecology Thank you for taking my call.
All right. Thanks for calling. Can you respond to that, Steve?
Well, I mean, there are some differences here between in I think the oil spill that many people use as their reference point is the Exxon Valdez spill. In that case, the oil was washing ashore in many cases in a very rocky area. You were having to scrub the rocks, the shoreline.
And the wildlife.
And in this case, obviously, it's coming onto these sort of marshy areas, islands that are off of Louisiana. I think that probably does offer a different kind of challenge than what was faced in Exxon Valdez.
Jackie.
Well, you know, I think what the caller might be referring to is the use of dispersants to address the oil, because that's something they're doing where they actually spray other chemicals, which also happen to be toxic. And what it does is it takes the oil and sort of loosens it up like the Dawn dishwashing does in your bacon grease, right? And it takes the oil and it compartmentalizes it so it sinks down into the water column. Now, this is what I mean by a lose-lose situation, and I know that they got to do something, and it may be the lesser of two evils to use dispersants. But what they're really doing is they're saying, we're going to trade oil washing up on the beach, which we know we don't want, it looks bad, it's bad for birds, with oil that now stays in the water column where it's exposed to marine fish, larvae, sea turtles, and all these other animals.
What about the earlier effort to burn off the oil? What happened there, Jackie?
You know, it's another lose-lose situation, and that's why I think we have to say to ourselves, we're being forced to accept a lot of really imperfect solutions.
No, but why didn't that work? Why wouldn't it work?
It's hard to corral oil on the surface of it's water, right, and start a fire, especially when the wind picks up and the waves pick up, and I think that's what they had.
Jackie Savage, she's Pollution Campaign Director and Senior Scientist for Oceana. Short break, and we'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the German Embassy and the German Information Center, whose Germany.info publishes news and politics, culture and lifestyle at Germany.info. By the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at MelvilleTrust.org. And by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. This is NPR.
A story about five families hoping to adopt baby girls from China. Novelist Ann Hood weaves together their accounts with the heartbreaking stories of the mothers who gave up their infants. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And here's an email from Nancy, who's in Fruitland Park, Florida. She says, I'm a lifelong Floridian. I oppose drilling near our beautiful state and always feared that this kind of tragedy would happen. I feel betrayed. What's done is done. But I'm not hearing what the rest of the oil industry is doing to help out. BP should not shoulder all of this. Is not the industry responsible to ensure this is fixed as soon as possible and doesn't happen again, Ray?
Well, they are all of all of the major oil companies right now have offered and lended their assistance to BP. BP has made a call out to all of them. They're working behind the scenes with their engineers or problem solvers to try to find a way to fix this leak as fast as they can. They're trying new things. They're using the dispersants underwater. They're creating this dome that's never been used before at that level. And they're also looking right now at BP to drill another well to take the pressure off of this one. So there is nothing and no one that they're throwing everything they can at this problem, and there's no holds back. I mean, every single idea, every single vessel, the dispersants, whatever we can to stop this, we're doing this.
The Obama administration and Secretary of the Interior Ken Salazar actually hosted a meeting of the major oil company representatives last Thursday night, put all the different ideas on the table, and I was told by one of the participants in the meeting that it was somewhat difficult because they don't know yet what caused the accident, so it's difficult to figure out exactly what is the right solution. But he asked that the participants in that meeting, the oil and gas representatives, to give him their best ideas by the close of business Friday. So that is what happened.
Now, here's an email from Paul, who says, what about a BOP valve on offshore drilling rigs? Please have your guests comment on other countries requiring an acoustic amplifier as a fail-safe to back up the BOP. Mike.
Well, that would be a remote shutoff that is law in Brazil and Norway, and there are those who speculate that had there been one in the Gulf of Mexico on the Deepwater Horizon rig, that this could have been prevented.
Why don't we require such?
Frankly, a lot of lobbying from the oil industry. It costs money. It's another regulation. And as we hear how much the oil industry is coming together and circling wagons and trying to solve this problem in the Gulf of Mexico, that's great. I just wish the oil industry would come together to solve our other problems related to oil, like climate change. Instead, the oil industry...
Okay, I don't want to get off on that raid. Do you want to come in on this backup?
Yes, I do, because it's not known at all. The fact is, the blowout preventer didn't work. Having a switch in a different location would not have made a difference.
But what about
as far as we know,
acoustic amplifier?
Right, that's having the ability remotely. They have robots down there now. It's supposed to kick in automatically when the pressure builds up. That blowout preventer is there exactly for that. So having a switch or an acoustic thing that you can do it remotely is not going to be a help in this situation. It did not work.
Steve?
Yeah, I mean, there appears to be some sort of failure with this equipment, the blowout preventer that they did have on it, and why it didn't work is a mystery. I think you are going to see more attention coming from Washington on this issue of the acoustic valve, whether or not the MMS mm-hmm. should have required it. The MMS a couple of years ago also proposed essentially requiring that the safety plans of the offshore oil operators be audited independently by independent parties once every 2 or 3 years. They did not follow through on that recommendation. The several of the major oil companies, including BP, opposed it. They said it was too costly, really wouldn't have improved safety. But I do think you're going to see more attention in the coming days on these issues. Congress is going to start holding hearings in the coming days, and I think that you are going to see more questions.
All right. To Kevin in Belleville, Indiana. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you. My question is, how large a diameter is the wellhead, and how much pressure it has, and is there any way you could cap it off by, you know, like blowing it up?
Anybody?
No, I don't know the size of it, and I'm fairly certain you just can't blow it up. That's why they're that would probably make it a lot worse, a bigger spill. But that's why they're trying to build or drill a parallel well to take some of that pressure off. They're on that platform itself. The pressure is monitored constantly, and so it's not just a blowout preventer. There are people manning this. You can have as many as three people looking at the same computer screen. It's kind of like having three air traffic controllers, just redundant built-in systems on those platforms. But no, we don't know. Certainly not an explosion wouldn't help.
To Patchogue, New York. Good morning, Holly.
Yes, good morning. I'd like to address this. the floater Deepwater Horizon was manufactured in South Korea. I would like to know if anyone has bothered to translate the schematics, BP and any transoceanic, anyone has bothered to translate the schematics and found any glitches in the schematics of the oil rig.
Right.
They're going to look at every single thing, and we are going to find out what happened, and we're going to fix it. So there's not anything that is not going to be really examined sharply by everybody, by industry and by government.
So here we are facing this horrible situation. We don't know how much further it's going to go. We don't know how much longer it's going to last. What comes next, Steve?
Well, as I was saying, the immediate task is just trying to stop the leak, and they're trying to do that through a number of different ways, through the containment domes, through trying to put in a new shutoff valve down there. They're also, as we were talking about earlier, shooting chemical dispersants at the source to try to disperse the pollution. And what comes next? I mean, already you're starting to see hearings that are being announced. The Senate Energy Committee is going to have a hearing, going to take Ken Salazar's testimony, find out what his agency was doing prior to this. The House Energy and Commerce Committee, chaired by Henry Waxman, they're going to have a hearing next week. They've asked the CEOs of the companies that are involved here to come testify. It's not clear whether or not that's going to happen. So you are going to start to see some effort by people in Washington to find out what's going on.
Here's an email from James in Richmond, Texas. He says, one of your guests described the containment domes as something that stops the leak. The dome simply captures some of the oil. It does not stop the leak. They place the dome over the leak. The leak continues. The oil, in theory, goes into the dome. They then pump the leaked oil to the surface and into a vessel instead of leaking into the Gulf. In theory, it should work, but they really don't know. Jackie.
Well, I think that's right, and I think that's all of our understanding of it. It doesn't necessarily stop the leak, and they may have to continue working on that relief well, which we hope will work. Of course, we're a mile underground. I'm not sure we should have been drilling there in the first place. But if you don't mind, getting back to your question about, you know, is the rest of the oil industry coming to the table, I think, and what's going to happen next, I think we're seeing a major change in public opinion about offshore drilling right now. We're seeing politicians that are changing their positions, and we may see the oil industry have a harder time arguing for opening up new places to drill. So what that makes me think is, if I'm the oil industry, maybe they ought to be thinking about making a commitment to the American public to build a certain amount of renewable energy. Say, we commit to 100 gigawatts of, instead of offshore oil, how about offshore wind? And start going beyond petroleum, as BP used to like to say they were doing.
Ray.
I would like to address that. This industry invests more than any other industry I'm aware of in new and renewable sources of energy. We are a big investor in wind and solar and geothermal, but the fact is those technologies account for about 1% of U.S. energy use. We are going to need oil and natural gas in our future. We believe in bringing every resource to bear, and we know we're going to need the oil and natural gas. 65 to 75% of our resources are offshore. We are going to go back. We are going to fix this problem. And we are all for these new and renewable, but they are not the answer. We're going to need decades worth of oil and natural gas. Decades.
Mike. Well, that sounds good, but the reality is the oil and gas industry has deployed 700 lobbyists to Washington in the last 12 months to kill climate legislation, major clean energy legislation. ExxonMobil puts a tiny fraction of its tens of billions of annual dollars in profits into anything renewable. The oil industry needs to become an energy industry, needs to make the transition to clean renewable energy, because we're going to continue to get spills like this through human error. The cost of business is too high. Public opinion is about to change, and we're ready for the next thing. And we need to see the oil industry circle wagons and work cooperatively, not just to put out their spills, but to take us to the next level of clean energy.
Steve, do you believe that public opinion and political opinion are likely to change as a result of this spill regarding offshore drilling?
I think it's really too early to say. I know that may not be the answer you want to hear, but it really is going to depend in the next few days. I mean, I think at the very least, it's going to make it very hard for the oil and gas industry to get a significant expansion in offshore drilling just until the cause of this thing is known. I think the best hope that the industry has right now is that if they find that it was a isolated error by some individuals, and if they can contain the damage as much as possible, maybe they can contain it to being a case of a bad industrial accident as opposed to endemic of the industry as a whole.
Here's an email from Michael in Gainesville, Florida, who says, I sail and fish in the southwest Florida coast. In the 10,000 islands area, this is the largest pristine wilderness west of the Mississippi. I've read one researcher who advised the slick will stay offshore and circle the peninsula, missing the west coast and impacting the east coast. Please comment on the risk to our pristine southwest Florida coast and Keys. Jackie.
I'd be happy to. Excuse me. I'm also a big fan of South Florida. And I think the answer is, honestly, we don't really know. It really is going to depend a lot on the wind and the weather and the currents. As I think Mike was mentioning earlier, there is a loop current. If the wind blows the oil southward, which is not what it's doing now, it's blowing it northward, but if it shifts, it could get into the loop current that could take it around to the east coast of Florida, the Miami, Fort Lauderdale, West Palm Beach area. Whether that's going to happen or not, we don't know. The wind could shift and, you know, keep blowing it sort of to the northeast, and it could end up hitting northwest Florida. The bottom line is we don't have control of it anymore, and I think that's the problem.
Jackie Savage of Oceana, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Steve Power, is it true that federal authorities learned in 2004 that a vital piece of oil drilling safety equipment might not function in deep sea waters?
Yeah, this is a story in my paper today about there was a study that was commissioned by the Minerals Management Service. This is the agency that regulates the nation's offshore waters. There was a study done that looked at these shear rams, which are sometimes needed to cut off a pipe and try to contain a spill. There were some questions raised about whether or not this equipment would work given the increasing depths at which the oil and gas industry is now going to get the petroleum out of the seabed. And there was a study that found that that this equipment might not work at the increasing depths to which the industry was going.
So the U.S. government did not try to enforce that this new piece of equipment be installed.
One of the questions that we're trying to find out, and which we just have not yet, is why then was there no action taken? I mean, the government did not, appears not to have, the agency involved appears not to have taken any action on that finding.
All right, let's go now to Oklahoma City and to Ron. You're on the air.
Diane, I own a seafood market here in Oklahoma City, and my concern is that the churn of the waves are going to cause the droplets of oil to fall to the ocean floor. If that happens, it's going to be a bigger problem than we're thinking about just on the surface.
Jackie, would you agree?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, a lot of people say oil and water don't mix. And I guess that's true in a figurative way. But literally, there are components of oil that do dissolve in water. We don't see them floating on the surface, but that's what animals in the water are being exposed to. And then on top of that, when you decide to apply dispersants, you're facilitating the movement of the oil into the water. And yeah, it's better for the birds on the beach, but it's not necessarily better for the shrimp.
You know, Paul Krugman wrote a column this morning in the Washington Post asking, could some good come from this spill? What's your reaction, Mike?
Well, you look at the long-suffering people of Louisiana, and that, you know, one set of people should not have to bear so many tragedies. We had Katrina, 1,800 dead, $100 billion in damage. They're still recovering from it. Now these same coastal people in Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana are experiencing this. You know, a friend of mine says human beings have to learn everything the hard way, the hardest way possible. You know, one world war wasn't enough to sell Europeans on peace. I think that we're seeing in the Gulf Coast the consequences of our energy choices. Katrina was a catastrophic hurricane. We've seen a growth in hurricanes related to warmer waters, linked to global warming, and it's all connected to carbon fuels, especially oil and coal. This second tragedy clearly related to fossil fuels. I think the good that can come out of this is maybe we've learned a lesson a second time. We need to seek alternatives to the oil and the coal that we use to power this country.
Steve.
Well, one of the things that I've just been struck by in talking to some of the elected officials in Louisiana has been how often they caveat their comment by saying, but we don't want the federal government to abolish offshore drilling or stop offshore drilling. I talked to a state representative named Sam Jones. He's a Democrat. He served in the administration of Kathleen Blanco, who was the governor at the time of Katrina. He is very critical of BP's handling of this situation, very critical of the state's handling of this spill and the federal government's response, which he thought was not fast enough. And yet at the same time, he kept saying to me, but I want to make sure your readers understand we do not want the federal government to take it out on the industry as a whole. And I think part of the reason for that is not just that this industry does provide a fair number of jobs in Louisiana, but it also provides a lot of revenue for royalties.
And therein may lie the final word. Stephen Power, he's a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Thank you for coming in. Rayola Dewar, she's with the American Petroleum Institute. Michael Tidwell is author of Bayou Farewell and director of the Chesapeake Climate Action Network. Jackie Savage is Pollution Campaign Director, Senior Scientist at Oceana. We'll continue to follow this. Thanks for being here. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.